reading this week about Paul quoting one of the popular singers of the day, which I felt like made Paul the first youth pastor, right? To insert a Justin Bieber quote into the sermon. Now that I have that out of my system, let's pray. Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable. And already confusing people. This guy is a babbler, they conclude. Someone who picks up ideas here and there. There's no coherence, no beauty, no logic. Others assume he must be introducing some new god into the already crowded mix of Athenian idols. This is all extremely weird, but we're always up for something new, so let's hear it. And at this point, perhaps inserting myself here, can almost feel the imposter syndrome oozing out of Paul. He's brought to the Areopagus. It's like a debate chamber, but set on this hill. And Paul really gives it all he's got. He quotes several philosophers and popular poets of the day, lays it all out there. I know that Paul often comes across as a confident, ambitious orator, but he was a Pharisee. He was trained as a Jew, knowing how to live the law of Moses. These are not his people, these are not his ideas, and these are definitely not his gods. My guess is he had to brush up on the Sophocles for this very occasion. But it's interesting that Paul doesn't start out by going up against their ideas. He's troubled by their idols. And his speech kicks off by getting this inkling of an idea as he's passing by this little altar with the words, "to an unknown God." It's perfect because it offers back exactly what idols are, a self-deception. Willie Jennings writes, "Idols are where human fantasy and wish, circulating around material realities, generate a distorted hope." A distorted hope. Idols make space for us to believe our lives are our own, that they're in our control. Idols don't create something else, they're creations of us. When they're made in our image. Because we can pick and choose among the gods, we get to choose our idols. There's no religion in the ancient world, at least nothing like we would describe as religion. There was no membership, no order, no allegiance. It's not like you're a part of a community or joining a church or a mosque. There's only keeping up with the various gods. That's what Paul means when he says you're very religious. You might, writes Rowan Williams, have a favorite among the gods. You might find the temple of Jupiter more attractive than the temple of Venus. You may like to go to this festival rather more than you like to go to this other festival. You might fancy the rites of Mithras to have yourself drenched in the blood of a freshly slaughtered bull. You might, if you are very reckless, decide that you're attracted to the cult of the goddess Sibyl, perhaps to be slightly deterred when you find out the price of being a cleric is to become a eunuch. What it meant to be in Rome, to be Athenian, what it meant to be a part of the cultus of the ancient world, is to throw a few coins here, to take a bath in bull's blood there. The idea of leaving, that actually doesn't make sense. Because civic life, all of life, revolves around dabbling in these gods. When the people of Athens greet Paul, they're very open-minded. Of course, who would not want to throw another god into the pot of Athens' social world? But Paul isn't looking for people to switch teams, to pick a religious community. It just didn't exist. He wants to show them a different world, He wants to give them a new order to reality. To leave idols behind is to leave the entire Roman world behind, the very ordering of their lives. He's offering them the story about a creation that pulls at the seams until the very structure of reality unravels. Often when people in church have read this story, they hear it as the birthplace of something that has been called apologetics. Some of you heard this word before, apologetics. Apologetics is a way to utilize the intellectual world around us to make faith reasonable. In the King James Version of the Bible, the Areopagus, where Paul is led, is translated Mars Hill. Some of you heard of Mars Hill before? You might have heard of that because there are churches and institutes and colleges named Mars Hill because they're dedicated to this project of debating and discoursing Christianity in the system of Western Enlightenment rationalism. But this isn't where this tradition of apologetics actually began. Early on in the first century, this was a way of defending these followers of Jesus against accusations of criminal activity, like being atheists. In other words, not worshiping the gods. And later on in the patristic period, this term apologetics is used to describe Christians attempting to show the absurdity of these Greco-Roman myths. And even later in the Middle Ages, it's the way that Christianity distinguishes itself from Islam and Judaism, and through some rather self-aggrandizing forms of biblical interpretation. It wasn't until the 18th century that Christianity began to utilize apologetics as a way to confirm the scientific viability of biblical text in the stories of faith. The idea behind this was that there was common sense presuppositions in the natural world, morality, truth, beauty, science, reason, and that these were all arguments for Jesus, for faith. But it was a man named James Orr who decidedly turned apologetics towards the Enlightenment in the 19th century. For Orr and others like him, there were two systems of thought, and the role of Christians was to argue non-Christians into the church's worldview. And the reason for this was that Christianity just created better outcomes for humanity, according to Orr. So why am I telling you all this? Perhaps because it's very likely that you have been subject to these forms of knowing, these ways of believing, without even knowing it. Because we breathe the air of the past every week, whether we know it or not. It's not unusual for me to meet someone who has lost their faith because they discovered that all the stories in the Bible are not historically accurate, or certainly that we can't verify whether they are or not. I know others who have learned that there's an ancient flood myth that looks curiously similar to the one in Genesis. And others simply cannot fathom that we believe, quite sincerely with a straight face, that dead people come back to life. Others look around and see truth and beauty in other religious communities, and they can no longer believe that the things that are said about God in the Bible. There are schools of thought, places named after Mars Hill, that do their best to tie these loose ends back together. They offer philosophical and scientific and phenomenological arguments for truth. And you may find what you need there. There are times when those arguments are appealing to me because it feels like a sure thing, something to compete with the academic and political and social realities that feel like they're pressing in on me every day. But what I love about God, what I found in Jesus, is what actually rises up from the words Paul speaks at the Areopagus. He doesn't give them an argument. He gives them a body. What it takes to believe, to make a mess out of your life, to turn your existence upside down, isn't gold or bronze statues. It's a human life. One in which the God who created everything has set down God's self among us. Paul's new order is one in which people are not the ones serving the arbitrary needs of the various gods, attending to the philosophy and flavor of the day. Instead, reality, the very universe, is a gift. It's an offering that is given. God doesn't need anything from us. There's nothing to complete God or appease God or fill God up or talk God into doing what we want or tricking God into something we are not. We are offsprings of God, Paul tells them, which is another way to say God is a parent and you are God's children. Wish I could see the looks on the faces of the Athenian when Paul says these words. You're the family of God, the same sort as God, the kindred. You have God's eyes. And if you want to know what God looks like, you don't look to reason or morality. You look to a crucified body of a peasant from Galilee, a backwater town in the middle of the most uncivilized place you can imagine. Oh, and by the way, he died and rose from the dead. And now we are his body alive in the world. Surprise! So if you're going to put a stake in your own brilliance and wonder, in your own ability to philosophically encounter the world, your own civic excellence, finding out that God doesn't dwell in lofty ideas, but in a body, in flesh, is more than absurd. It is foolish. The man who took no interest in the affairs of the state was not a man who minded his own business, but a man who had no business being in Athens at all, wrote one of the ancient poets. Those who refuse to participate in the rich civic life in Athens, with its idols and ideas, they were called idiots. For all the bridges that Paul is trying to cross by citing the overlap of these respected poets and philosophers of Athens, this is a bridge too far. It cannot be crossed with logic. It cannot be crossed with argument. It can only be crossed by love. That is a love that will one day judge and find wanting the pompous, overinflated confidence humans place on our own wisdom, our own ability to control the world. And when this is finally washed away, when human reliance on our own goodness and our own achievement is at last swept out of the way, in its place is not rejection or failure. In Athens 17, this judgment doesn't end with destruction. Instead, Paul tells the Athenians, we'll find love fully, love that refuses to stay dead, a love of a God who will not be God without us. God has given assurance to all by raising Jesus from the dead. Paul says he has given faith to all. At the end of the day, Paul doesn't seem to be there to debate ideas. He's there to offer them a love story, to offer them a living body, the living body of God, and to let trust in this person upend the very social order of their world. The Athenians are not upset. They just don't get it. Some scoff, but others say, actually, this is kind of interesting. Could you come back tomorrow and lay out some more arguments? Some are ready to consider putting up a little altar to Jesus right next to the other altars in Athens. And you know what Paul does? Doesn't research Socrates or come up with a point-by-point rebuttal. He leaves. He leaves. And a couple people come with him. Because Paul is not offering up another philosophy. He's offering the love of God that will change everything we know. As we've been reading Acts, it's been fascinating to see how much of our world is echoed back in these pages, how little changes from the second century to the present. It's actually a little creepy, right? 2005, David Foster Wallace told the graduating class of Kenyon College, "In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. Something will order our lives. There's no getting around it. It might be patriotism or wealth creation. It might be piety. It might be the job we do. It might even be the work of justice." I suspect that this is true for me, that more often than I like to think, I shelve Jesus among the other gods in my life, another philosophy to pick up when it's convenient for me. I know that I am always undoing the idol worship in my own life. The strangest thing about this adventure of following Jesus is that the new order we're offered doesn't begin with rational arguments or coherent philosophy. It doesn't begin with us at all. It begins with God, who forms creation and you in it to give you the world, the entire world, as a gift. And if you follow this story, allow it to undo the old orders of coercion and violence, of self-certainty and individualism, of nationalism and hoarding wealth, you'll find that the beginning and end of all things is a God who says yes to you over and over again. The beginning and end of all things is an incomprehensible and foolish love of Jesus Christ. Amen.